A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a follow-up to a conversation we had about the scripts we inherit. The life paths we absorb by osmosis, the ones that feel like our own desires, but might just be the water we've been swimming in. The question is, how do you actually do the unpacking work? What heuristics and strategies exist, especially ones with evidence behind them, for sorting through what's authentically yours and what was handed to you? And critically, it's not binary. Some of the script might genuinely resonate. The challenge is separating the signal from the noise. So where do we even start with this?
I think the place to start is acknowledging that this isn't a new problem. People have been wrestling with exactly this tension for decades, and there's actually a rich clinical tradition around it. Eric Byrne, the psychiatrist who founded transactional analysis in the late 1950s, wrote a book in 1961 called Transactional Analysis in Psychotherapy, and he introduced this concept of the script almost exactly the way the prompt is using it, a life plan decided in childhood, reinforced by parents, that a person follows unconsciously into adulthood.
Byrne literally used the word script.
He literally used the word script, and he differentiated between winning scripts, losing scripts, and what he called non-winning or banal scripts. Lives that just sort of flatline, no catastrophe but no real fulfillment either. And his core insight, which I think is still underappreciated, is that the script isn't just a set of beliefs. It's a full dramatic structure. There's a cast of characters, there are expected plot turns, there's a predicted ending. People will sabotage their own success because success would violate the script.
The tragedy that knows its own ending.
And Byrne's therapeutic approach was to make the script conscious. He'd have patients literally write out their life script as if it were a play, with stage directions and dialogue. Once you see it on paper, you can't unsee it. That's the first heuristic right there. Externalize it. Get it out of your head and onto a page where you can look at it like an editor, not an actor.
Step one is basically literary criticism of your own life.
I mean that unironically. There's actually empirical support for this. James Pennebaker, a social psychologist at the University of Texas at Austin, has spent decades studying what he calls expressive writing. His foundational studies from the 1980s and 90s showed that when people write about emotionally significant experiences for 15 to 20 minutes over 3 or 4 days, they show measurable improvements in immune function, fewer doctor visits, better academic performance. But the mechanism isn't just catharsis, it's the construction of a coherent narrative. Pennebaker found that the people who benefited most were the ones whose writing shifted from disorganized, fragmented sentences to structured, causal accounts. This happened, which led to this, and I now understand that
it's not venting, it's sense-making.
And the linguistic markers are fascinating. Pennebaker's text analysis software, the Linguistic Inquiry and Word Count Program, tracks what he calls cognitive words. Words like because, therefore, realize, understand. As people's writing becomes more coherent, their use of these words increases. That's the story they're constructing. The people whose health improved were literally building a narrative framework that made sense of their experience.
Which connects directly to the script idea. If you can't see the script, you can't edit it. But once you've written it down and you're using words like because and therefore to connect the dots, you're no longer just living it. You're analyzing it.
That brings us to the second big piece, which is identifying where the script came from. Byrne talked about parental programming, the explicit and implicit messages you received. But more recent work, particularly in acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT, has refined this into something more nuanced. Stephen Hayes, who developed ACT in the 1980s, talks about cognitive fusion, the state where you're so fused with a thought or a belief that you can't separate yourself from it. The thought, I must become a doctor, isn't just a thought you have. It's a thought that has you.
The thought that has you. That's a good phrase.
Hayes uses a technique called cognitive diffusion to break that grip. One exercise is to take a recurring self-critical or script-driven thought and sing it to the tune of Happy Birthday, or say it in a cartoon character voice. The point isn't to dispute the thought's truth. That's what cognitive behavioral therapy does, and that's valuable too. The point is to change your relationship to the thought, to see it as a mental event, not a command.
You're not arguing with the script. You're stepping outside it and realizing it's just words.
There's a growing evidence base for this. A meta-analysis published in the Journal of Contextual Behavioral Science in 2020 looked at 68 randomized controlled trials of ACT and found moderate to large effect sizes for reducing anxiety and depression. More specifically, studies that measured cognitive diffusion directly found that it mediates the therapeutic effect. It's not just that ACT helps generally, we can see that diffusion specifically is doing the work.
Let me push on something though. The prompt raises a really specific wrinkle that I think complicates both the burn and the ACT approaches. It says, and I'm paraphrasing, some of the script might actually be right for you. Some of the values you are imbued with resonate. It's not like you're a blank slate and the script is all contamination. How do you distinguish between the parts of the script that are authentically yours and the parts that are borrowed?
This is where it gets hard, and I think a lot of self-help literature glosses over this. The usual advice is some version of listen to your heart or find your passion, which is completely useless when your heart has been programmed and your passions might be borrowed.
Follow your bliss, said the person whose bliss was never colonized by their parents' expectations.
So I want to offer two frameworks that take this seriously. The first comes from self-determination theory, which was developed by Edward Deci and Richard Ryan at the University of Rochester starting in the 1970s. They argue that human well-being depends on three basic psychological needs, autonomy, competence, and relatedness. And they make a crucial distinction between intrinsic motivation and what they call introjected regulation.
Break that down.
Introjected regulation is when you've internalized an external demand, but you haven't fully integrated it. You're doing something to avoid guilt or anxiety or to maintain self-esteem, but you don't truly endorse the value behind it. It feels like it's coming from inside you, but it's actually a foreign body wrapped in self-talk. Deci and Ryan describe it as regulation by the dynamics of self-esteem. You're a lawyer because your father wanted you to be a lawyer, but you've told yourself you want it so convincingly that you can't tell the difference anymore.
The psychological equivalent of a rejected organ transplant.
That's not a bad analogy. The body, the psyche, accepts it enough that it doesn't reject it outright, but there's chronic low-level inflammation. And the way you spot interjected regulation, according to the research, is through the quality of the motivation. Intrinsic motivation and fully integrated motivation feel expansive. They're associated with greater interest, excitement, and confidence. Interjected regulation feels constrictive. It's associated with anxiety, pressure, and contingent self-worth. I'm okay only if I succeed at this.
The diagnostic question is not, do I want this? It's, how does wanting this feel in my body?
Deci and Ryan have the data to back this up. Across hundreds of studies, they've found that interjected regulation is consistently associated with lower well-being, higher anxiety, and poorer performance than autonomous motivation. People driven by interjects burn out faster and achieve less than people doing the same thing for autonomous reasons. The script doesn't just make you unhappy, it makes you worse at the thing you're doing.
Which is a cruel irony. You're grinding yourself down to fulfill someone else's vision, and you're not even doing it well.
And this connects to what the prompt is really asking about, the discovery process. How do you move from interjected regulation to something more autonomous? Deci and Ryan's research points to something they call self-reflection and integrative processing. It's not about rejecting external influences wholesale. It's about actively considering them, examining them, and either endorsing them as your own or setting them aside. They found that when people engage in what they call autonomous self-reflection, reflecting without self-criticism, without pressure, they're more likely to identify and pursue goals that fit them.
The process itself has to be autonomous. You can't bully yourself into authenticity.
That's the paradox. If you're approaching self-discovery like a self-improvement project with deadlines and metrics, you're already doing it wrong. The means have to match the ends.
You mentioned two frameworks. What's the second?
The second comes from the existential psychotherapy tradition, particularly the work of Irvin Yalom. Yalom wrote extensively about what he called the four ultimate concerns of existence: death, freedom, isolation, and meaninglessness. But the one that's most relevant here is freedom. Specifically, the terrifying freedom of creating your own meaning and taking responsibility for your choices.
Yalom's basically saying the script is a defense mechanism against freedom.
He argued that people cling to external scripts precisely because genuine freedom is anxiety-provoking. If you're following a script, you don't have to face the vertigo of choosing. You don't have to confront the possibility that there is no preordained path. Yalom developed a therapeutic approach that's deeply Socratic. He would ask patients to imagine their own death in detail, not to be morbid, but to surface what actually matters to them. What would you regret not having done? Who would you regret not having been?
The mortality filter.
There's empirical support for this, too. Terror management theory, which grew out of the work of cultural anthropologist Ernest Becker, has shown in dozens of studies that reminders of mortality shift people's priorities. When people are reminded of death, they become more invested in their core values and less concerned with external validation. The script loses its grip.
The heuristic is, imagine you're dying. What suddenly seems irrelevant.
What suddenly seems urgent? Yalom would ask patients to write their own obituary or to imagine their funeral and what they'd want people to say. It's not a party trick, it's a way of cutting through the noise. When you're facing the reality of a finite life, the borrowed scripts tend to fall away because you realize you've been spending your limited time on someone else's priorities.
I want to connect this back to something you said earlier about writing it down. There's a through line here across Byrne, Pennebaker, Hayes, Desi and Ryan, and Yalom. Every single one of them is saying, get it out of your head. Write the script. Write the narrative. Write the obituary. Sing the thought in a silly voice. The common thread is externalization. Making the invisible visible so you can actually look at it.
That's not a coincidence. The human brain is terrible at examining its own contents while it's using them. It's like trying to see your own eyeball. You need a mirror. Writing is the mirror. Conversation is the mirror. Therapy is the mirror. Anything that reflects your own thinking back to you in a form you can examine.
Let's talk about the conversation piece for a moment. Because the prompt mentions that this is hard to do alone, and I think that's right. You can't always see your own blind spots by definition.
This is where the evidence for social feedback gets interesting. There's a line of research on what's called the Johari window. It was developed by psychologists Joseph Luft and Harrington Ingham in 1955. The basic idea is that there are things you know about yourself and things you don't, and there are things others know about you and things they don't. The quadrant where others know something about you that you don't know yourself, that's the blind spot, and the only way to shrink it is through feedback.
Which is uncomfortable by design.
But the research suggests it's also effective. A analysis published in the Journal of Applied Psychology in 2003 looked at the effectiveness of multi-source feedback, what organizations call 360 feedback, and found that when feedback is combined with a structured development plan, it leads to measurable behavior change. The key is that the feedback has to come from people who actually see you in different contexts. Your spouse sees a version of you that your coworkers don't. Your close friends see patterns that your family might miss. Each relationship is a different mirror.
Part of the discovery process is literally asking people, what do you see in me that I don't see in myself?
Being willing to hear answers that might contradict your self-image. But there's a nuance here that I think is important. Not all feedback is created equal. The people you ask should be people who want your flourishing, not people who are invested in maintaining the script. If you ask your parents to help you figure out whether your career path is authentically yours, and your parents are the ones who wrote that script in the first place,
you're asking the author for editorial notes on their own manuscript.
You need outside readers.
We've got several heuristics on the table. Externalize the script through writing. Use cognitive diffusion to loosen the grip of script-driven thoughts. Check the quality of your motivation, expansive or constrictive. Use mortality as a filter for what matters, and seek structured feedback from people who aren't invested in the script. But I want to go back to something the prompt mentioned that we haven't fully addressed. It says this is relevant, no matter what stage of life you're at. Is there evidence that this process works differently at different ages?
There is, and it's actually encouraging. The traditional view in developmental psychology, going back to William James and later Erik Erikson, was that identity formation is primarily a task of adolescence and early adulthood. Erikson's stages of psychosocial development placed identity versus role confusion squarely in the teenage years. The implication was that by the time you're an adult, the work is done.
Which is a terrifying thought if you're 40 and still confused.
More recent research has complicated that picture significantly. The concept of emerging adulthood, which Jeffrey Jensen Arnett proposed in 2000, extended the identity formation window into the 20s. And beyond that, there's a growing body of work on what's called narrative identity in midlife and later adulthood. Dan McAdams at Northwestern University has been studying this for decades. He argues that we're constantly revising our life stories and that major life transitions, career changes, divorce, health crises, the empty nest, are opportunities for what he calls narrative reconstruction.
The script isn't just written once in childhood. It's revised and reissued across the lifespan.
McAdams describes identity as an internalized and evolving story that provides unity, purpose, and meaning. The key word is evolving. You're not stuck with the first draft. And his research shows that people who engage in what he calls autobiographical reasoning, actively reflecting on their past experiences and drawing lessons from them, tend to have higher well-being and greater ego development. It's never too late to edit the narrative.
Which means the heuristics we're discussing aren't just for 20-somethings having a quarter-life crisis. They're for anyone at any point who feels like their life is running on tracks they didn't lay.
There's a particularly interesting study on this from the Harvard Study of Adult Development, which is the longest-running longitudinal study of human life ever conducted. It started in 1938 and followed the same individuals for over 80 years. Robert Waldinger, the current director, has written about what they found. The people who were happiest and healthiest in old age weren't necessarily the ones who followed a straight path. They were the ones who adapted, who revised their sense of what mattered, who stayed curious about themselves. Rigidity was a predictor of unhappiness. Flexibility was a predictor of flourishing.
This script isn't just what was handed to you. It's also the refusal to revise.
The script is as much about rigidity as it is about content. You could have a script that says, be a doctor, and that's the content. But the deeper script is, follow the plan and don't question it. That script is the real problem.
Let's get practical. Someone's listening to this and they're thinking, okay, I'm in my 40s, I've been on a track that I'm not sure is mine, and I want to start the unpacking work. What's the actual sequence? What's the evidence-based protocol?
I don't think there's a single protocol that's been validated in a randomized controlled trial for life script unpacking as such, but we can piece together a sequence from the evidence we've discussed. Step one, and I think this has to come first, is the Pennebaker exercise. 4 days, 15 to 20 minutes each day. Write continuously about your life trajectory and the forces that shaped it. Don't edit. Don't worry about grammar. Just get it out. The goal is to see the narrative as it currently exists.
The raw footage, not the final cut.
Step two is to apply the burn lens. Go back through what you wrote and identify the script elements. What were the explicit messages you received? You should be a doctor. People like us don't do that. Success means X. And what were the implicit messages? The ones that were modeled but never stated? What were the rewards and punishments attached to different choices?
The family mythology audit.
Step three is the motivation quality check, drawing on Desi and Ryan. For each major life commitment, your career, your relationships, your hobbies, your location, ask yourself, does this feel expansive or constrictive? Am I doing this because I value it, or because not doing it would trigger guilt, shame, or anxiety? If the answer is the latter, that's an introject, not an autonomous choice.
What if the answer is, I value it, but I also would feel guilty if I didn't do it? Because I think that's the messy reality for most people.
That's the hardest case, and I think DC and Ryan's framework acknowledges this. They don't treat motivation as binary. It's a continuum. You can have mixed motives. The question is the ratio. And the goal isn't to eliminate all interjected motivation. That's probably impossible. The goal is to shift the center of gravity toward the autonomous end of the spectrum over time.
It's not about purity. It's about direction of travel.
And that takes the pressure off. You don't need to have a completely authentic, unborrowed life. You just need to be moving in that direction.
Which is a much more humane standard.
Step 4 would be the Yalom exercise. Write your own obituary. Or imagine your 80th birthday party and write the speech someone who loves you would give. What would you want them to say? What would you regret if it went unsaid? This surfaces the values that are yours, the ones that survive the mortality filter. Step 5 is the feedback loop. Take what you've discovered through the writing and the reflection and test it against the perceptions of a few trusted people. Not to have them tell you what to do, but to check for blind spots. Ask them, what do you see in me that I might not see? What patterns have you noticed? Where do I seem most alive, and where do I seem like I'm going through the motions?
Then step 6 is probably the hardest one. Actually making changes based on what you've found.
Which is where the evidence on behavior change comes in. And I want to be careful here because a lot of popular advice about behavior change is wildly overconfident. But there are some things we know. Implementation intentions, what researchers call if-then plans, are more effective than vague goals. Peter Galwitzer's work at NYU has shown this consistently. Instead of, I want to spend more time on creative work, you say, if it's Saturday morning, then I will spend 2 hours writing before I check email.
The specificity forces the action.
It bypasses the willpower problem. The cue triggers the behavior automatically. Galwitzer's analyses show that implementation intentions have medium to large effect sizes on goal attainment across a wide range of behaviors. It's one of the most robust findings in the whole behavior change literature.
The sequence is, write the raw narrative, audit the script, check the motivation quality, filter through mortality, gather feedback, and then make specific if-then plans for change. That's a pretty comprehensive protocol.
I want to add one more piece that I think is under-discussed. The prompt mentions that this is doubly hard when you layer confusion on top of the normal difficulty of self-discovery. And I think there's a specific reason for that which the research supports. When you're operating from an interjected script, you're expending a tremendous amount of cognitive and emotional energy just maintaining the performance. It's like running a background process that's eating up your CPU. You don't have the spare capacity for genuine exploration.
The script is a resource drain.
And this connects to something called ego depletion, which is the idea, somewhat controversial, I should say, there's been a replication debate. But the core observation that self-control and decision-making draw on a limited resource has held up reasonably well in analyses. If you're constantly managing the dissonance between what you're doing and what you actually want, you're depleting yourself. You're tired all the time, and you don't know why.
Part of the discovery process might involve doing less before you can do more, reducing the cognitive load of the performance, so you have the bandwidth to figure out what you actually want.
That might mean temporarily stepping back from commitments that feel script-driven, even if you're not sure yet whether they're authentically yours. Create a gap, a sabbatical, a reduced schedule, a period of experimentation. The research on incubation and creativity is relevant here. Sometimes you need to stop actively working on the problem for the insight to emerge.
There's a paradox in that. You have to stop trying to find yourself in order to find yourself.
Which is very consistent with the ACT approach. It's not about trying harder to think your way to authenticity. It's about creating the conditions where authenticity can emerge naturally.
Let me push on something. We've been talking about this as an individual process, and that makes sense given the nature of the prompt. But I wonder if there's a cultural dimension we're missing. The prompt mentions that scripts can be imbibed by osmosis, not just through direct parental programming. And the osmotic medium is culture. If you're growing up in a particular community, a particular class, a particular country, the script isn't just what your parents told you. It's what everyone around you assumes is normal and desirable.
This is a huge point, and it connects to something that the cultural psychologist Hazel Rose Marcus at Stanford has been studying for decades. She talks about the independent versus interdependent self-construal, the idea that different cultures shape different models of what a self even is. In more individualistic cultures, the self is seen as bounded, unique, and self-determining. The ideal is to stand out. In more collectivist cultures, the self is seen as relational, contextual, and defined by social roles. The ideal is to fit in.
Which means the script in a collectivist culture might not feel like a script at all. It might feel like reality.
Marcus's research shows that people from more interdependent cultures don't experience social expectations as external constraints in the same way. They experience them as constitutive of who they are. The line between self and role is much blurrier. And that makes the unpacking work we're describing culturally specific. The very idea that you should find your authentic self distinct from your social roles is itself a product of a particular cultural script.
We're using a culturally specific tool to solve a culturally specific problem, and we should be honest about that.
I think that's right. The heuristics we're discussing, the writing, the diffusion, the mortality filter, they're drawn primarily from a Western individualistic therapeutic tradition. They're not universal. They might not make sense or feel right to someone from a cultural context where the self is understood relationally.
Though I'd argue that the problem the prompt describes, the sense of living a life that isn't fully yours, shows up across cultures. It just takes different forms.
The form might be different, but the underlying distress is probably universal. And I think the adaptation is to adjust the heuristics to fit the cultural context. If the self is relational, then the discovery process should be relational too. Instead of writing alone in a room, you might have structured conversations with family members. Instead of asking, "What do I want?" you might ask, "What kind of person do I want to be in relation to the people I love?" The externalization still happens, but the medium is dialogue rather than solitary writing.
Which brings us back to the feedback step. In a relational context, that's not an add-on. That's the main event.
There's actually some interesting cross-cultural research on this. A study published in the Journal of Cross-Cultural Psychology in 2018 looked at the effectiveness of expressive writing across cultures and found that the benefits were present but culturally modulated. The mechanism seemed to shift. For participants from more individualistic cultures, the benefit came from self-expression. For participants from more collectivist cultures, the benefit came from making sense of social relationships. The writing was doing different psychological work, but it was still working.
The tool is adaptable. The core principle, externalize and examine, holds up. The form it takes is culturally contingent.
I think that's actually a more useful takeaway than a one-size-fits-all protocol. The principle is, find a way to get your assumptions, your shoulds, your taken-for-granted life narrative out where you can look at it. How you do that. Writing, talking, art, ritual depends on who you are and where you come from.
Let me ask you a question that might be uncomfortable. We've been talking about scripts as something to be escaped. But is there a case for the script? Is there a reason these things exist in the first place beyond just social control?
I think absolutely yes. Scripts reduce cognitive load. They provide structure and predictability. They connect you to a community and a lineage. If every person had to invent their life from scratch, with no inherited templates, most people would be paralyzed. The script isn't inherently bad. It becomes bad when it's rigid, when it's imposed rather than offered, and when it prevents you from adapting to your own changing needs and circumstances.
The goal isn't to be scriptless. It's to hold the script lightly.
That's a beautiful way to put it. Hold the script lightly. It's there as a resource, a reference, a tradition you can draw on. But you're the author, not the character. You can revise. You can improvise. You can take what works and leave what doesn't.
Which loops back to the prompt's insight that this isn't binary. Some of the script resonates. Some of it is yours. The work is discernment, not rejection.
Discernment is a practice, not an event. You don't do it once and you're done. You do it over and over across the lifespan as you change and as the world changes. That's the narrative reconstruction McAdams was talking about. It's ongoing.
If someone's listening and feeling overwhelmed by all of this, the writing exercises, the motivation audits, the obituary drafting, the feedback conversations, what's the one thing they should do tomorrow morning?
The Pennebaker exercise. Write about your life as if you're telling the story to someone who doesn't know you. Don't analyze, don't judge, just narrate. What happened, what you were told, what you believed, what you chose. The first draft of the script. That alone, even without any further steps, has a measurable effect, and it costs nothing except time and honesty.
If you do nothing else, you've at least seen the script on the page. You can't unsee it.
That's the threshold. Once you've externalized it, the process has already begun. Everything else is refinement. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1950s, a team of French biologists working in what was then French Somaliland advanced a widely accepted theory that axolotls could regenerate entire limbs because they retained embryonic stem cells throughout their bodies into adulthood. The theory dominated regeneration research for 2 decades before electron microscopy in the 1970s revealed that axolotls actually use dedifferentiation, mature cells reverting to a stem-like state, not retained embryonic cells. The entire field had been confidently wrong for 20 years.
20 years of confidently wrong. To wrap this up, the question of how to chart the trajectory of an authentic life doesn't have a clean answer, but it does have a direction. And the evidence suggests this is possible at any age, in any cultural context, with tools that are remarkably accessible. The hard part isn't the method, it's the willingness to look.
The willingness to tolerate the discomfort of not knowing, for a while, what's yours and what's borrowed. That ambiguity is the price of the process.
This has been My Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review if you're enjoying the show. It helps.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.